session number 21117, Wheel 1.
Albert Gregory, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Derby.
Which year was this?
1917.
Did both your mother and father come from Derby?
Yes, my mother and father were both born in Derby. My mother was born in the 1890s. My father was a few years before that. They both died now, of course.
What did your father do for a living?
He was in the First World War, the soldier. And then he spent most of his life working at what was known in those days as the British Colonies in Derby. He was unemployed in the 30s when they had all the unemployment time. But he was never a very rich man. I don't come from a rich family.
Was he a soldier in the First World War?
He was. Yeah, but not entirely through the war. He spent a certain period of time, and then he went back to work.
Which regiment did he serve with?
To be quite honest, I couldn't tell you. I'm sorry, I don't know. Yeah, I think his war service was very little, very short. But he was in the First World War.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Derby?
Yes.
Yeah. Which school did you go to?
I went to the local school where I lived in what they call Ulverston, which is the south side of Derby. And I went to school till I was 14. And I left school on the Friday. I went to work on the Saturday morning at 14.
What job was that?
As a butcher's assistant.
Did you do that for long?
I did that for about 2 years. And then I answered an advert for the Derby Co-op as a butcher's assistant. I had the interview, and they told me there's no longer any vacancies for that particular job. Would I go on to the transport, the co-op transport, which involved bread delivery? In those days, they used to go all over Derby, covered all Derby and district, delivering door-to-door bread delivery. So I said, yes, certainly, because in those days, working on the Derby co-op was a very good job. A higher paid job than the average others in Derby. So I just went, and instead of being a butcher, I started a different life as a bread delivery boy.
Did you join the Air Force before the war?
In 1939, the Air Force formed a Volunteer Reserve Centre in Derby, and they had a big house at the top of Broadway called Highfields, and volunteers went there volunteering for air gunners, wireless operators, navigators, pilots, and about six of us who were working on the Derby Co-op, we thought, well, we'll join the RAF.
Why?
Well, we thought at that particular time that having seen Chamberlain come back from meeting Hitler, this piece of paper in his hand saying, peace in our time. We thought, well, that's it, there's going to be a war. So what shall we do? Well, we didn't want to go in the army and be on the end of a rifle and bayonet. We didn't want to go in the Navy in case we got drowned. So this volunteer reserve in the RAF had just started in Derby, let's volunteer for aircrew, which we did.
Do you remember what month in 39 that was?
It was early 39, I'm afraid I don't remember the exact month, probably March, April.
What happened to you next?
Well, we did our training, ground training. I was training initially as an air gunner. And we used to go out to the Derby airport, which was known in those days as Burniston Airport. And that was mainly for the pilots, for their flying training on Tiger Moths and Magisters. We used to go out there just for the air experience. But on September the 1st, we were mobilised, put into uniform. September the 3rd, the war broke out. Then we had a group photograph of all of us on this big photograph. And over the ensuing weeks, we were all posted off in various directions according to what we'd volunteered for.
How did you feel about the announcement that war had been declared?
It was no problem. We were expecting it. I didn't think anything about it at all. It just came and that was it.
And then?
I was first posted from Derby to Aldergrove in Northern Ireland, near Belfast, to do my finishing up of my air gunner training. And I was there a few weeks, and then posted to 141 Squadron at Grangemouth in Scotland, who had Blenheims.
What did training for being an air gunner involve in those days?
Very little. Bit of firing a few .303s, and basically getting to know handling the guns, for instance, and how to dismantle it and put it together again, and that was about it.
What happened to you once you first arrived at Grangemouth?
Well, as I say, I went to Grangemouth and they're a Blenheim squadron, and I was doing flying training. They weren't operational at that time. But I'd only been there a few months, going into the new year of 1940, when they started converting to Defiance. And the turret on the Defiant, of course, was the mid-upper, four guns. I found personally no problem getting in and out of the turret. But an Air Ministry decoration came to all squadrons on Defiance saying that any air gunner above the height, I think it was about 5'10", would be considered too tall for the turret. And they had to be posted.
What height were you?
I was 6'1". So I pleaded with the CO not to post me because I was with friends of mine from Derby. We were all still together. But they said, no, we can do nothing about it. You'll go to another Blenheim squadron. So, of course, I was posted early May to 219 Squadron at Cuttrick, who were Blenheims. But regarding this posting, I was very lucky, actually, because initially the Defiance had a lot of considerable success in the south of England. But I'd shut a lot of the German aircraft down. But by the time 141 Squadron, the squadron that I'd left, went down to Hawkinge in Kent, the very first operational flight that they did, which was midday, I think in June of 1940, there was about 10 aircraft went up and 7 were shot out of the sky. So I considered that was my first near miss. Because if I'd have stayed with the squadron, no doubt I probably wouldn't be sitting here now.
What was this new squadron they posted you to?
Blenheims 219 at Cuttrick.
How did you feel about this new posting at the time?
Well, I just accepted it. It was there and that was it. I was going to another squadron who had the same aircraft that I was initially on, Blenheims. That was it. I didn't really, from memory, I didn't think anything about it. I just went and formed new friends, and that was it.
What was it like flying in the Blenheim?
I was quite happy. I was in the mid-upper turret. Well, there's only one turret, just with one gun, .303 Browning. And our base was at Cuttrick, but we used to fly to what we call a forward base at West Hartlepools on the east coast. So our main job was patrolling up and down the east coast if any enemy aircraft were coming in that way. I was very busy. There was a lot of flying in that period, in the Battle of Britain time.
Can you take me through any specific contacts with the enemy that stick out in your mind, please?
No, there's no real specific occasion that I can think about. It was just routine stuff. If we were directed to go off and fly off the east coast, if there were any of the German bombers coming in, we'd just go and just be, merely by our presence, we'd probably create some panic amongst the Germans and might maybe divert them from what they were doing. But if they had any fighter aircraft escorting them, we immediately had to get out of the way because we were not fast enough. The German fighters were faster than the Blenheim. We were only capable of doing about 250, 60 odd miles an hour. If the Germans bombers were coming over on their own, we'd have a go. But if there were any sign of their fighters escorting them, we'd get out of the way quick, because we couldn't cope.
What was the usual case, to have a fighter escort or not to have a fighter escort for the German Air Force?
Well, it varied. It could happen any time. There could be aircraft coming over with no escort at all, but infrequently there could be escorts with the bombers. There was no sort of pattern. It just happened one way or another. It's just a matter of finding out whether we got airborne or information given by the intelligence. But they lost such a lot of Blenheims, only one or two on our squadron, 219, but they lost such a lot of Blenheims in the day fighting that they were taken off day fighting and put on night only because of the losses.
So at this time in 1940, would you be directed specifically to a group of German planes, or would you just go and hope by chance to run into them?
It was a combination of both. We could be sitting on the ground at this forward base at West Hartlepool's, and we'd be suddenly told to get airborne because there was enemy fighter activity. Or we could be told to get airborne and just fly up and down the coast for any anticipated German activity. It could be a combination of both. But if I could tell you about the number of times I was airborne, from the middle of May, when I arrived at 219 Squadron, through until October, which was recognised to be the Battle of Britain time, I've got about 150 entries in my logbook. I was flying as many as between one and six times a day. Towards the end of August, which sticks out in my mind, was from the 29th of August on the afternoon until midnight on the 31st of August. That was just over 48 hours. I was airborne 15 times, 5 in one day, 4 in another day, and 6 in another day. So as far as being airborne, I was very busy, and we didn't have much time for sleep.
So what condition were you in when you were doing all this?
Quite well, really. Quite happy. At no time did I feel uncomfortable. I think mainly from my own personal point of view, I think because there was no actual personal involvement in the war that I was involved with. That's why we sort of decided to go into the Air Force. I mean, if we were involved with any German aircraft, there was nothing personal involved. It was our aircraft against the aircraft that we saw. If it was an enemy aircraft, that was it. There was nothing personal about it. And I think through that, it sort of didn't mean anything to me, really. It was just a routine job.
At this time, in the summer of 1940, were you opening fire very much on enemy aircraft?
Oh, no, no. Some days would go by with no contact at all. The other days were sort of quite involved. And although I personally was not involved with claiming any aircraft shot down, we were frequently involved with having a go. But more often than not, they'd got fighter escort. But we were hoping that they wouldn't have that escort, so we could get more involved. But once we realised that the fighter escort was there, we had to get out of the way. We were just too slow.
What method did the pilot adopt for getting out of the way?
Well, as soon as he realised that there was German fighters about, or if we were told over the RT, the radio of the aircraft from ground to air, we just immediately divert and get out of it and get back to base. if he considered it wasn't worth the risk of getting involved.
Would he go down to sea level?
No, we're mainly possibly anything between 10 and 20,000 feet.
But to escape from the fire?
Oh yes, we'll immediately dive from whatever height we were. Break away, dive down and just get away as fast as we could. We weren't followed usually because the German fighters, I understood, or I believe, were more involved with protecting their bombers. So if they saw any sign of British aircraft, such as ours, a Blenny, they wouldn't be very concerned. If they realised that we departed and got away, they'd just carry on escorting their bombers.
So you weren't chased?
No, hardly ever. To my knowledge, I don't think I personally was ever chased. No.
What do you remember about the other men in the squadron with whom you served at this time?
Well, the squadron consisted mainly of just pilots and air gunners. And I got on with them all very well. There were two flights, of course, an A and a B flight. And you get to know the people in the particular flight that you were in. And any time we had off, we used to go out and scout around, look for a pub with some beer and all that sort of thing. But we got on very well together. In fact, I'm still seeing, there are still five of us who are still alive, all air gunners, no pilots, and we still see each other every year from 1940 to 19 Squadron. The eldest is 96, a chap named Howard Dewitt. And in the Battle of Britain time, in 1940, he was 37. He was known as Grandad. We've got ages varying from 18 years of age until up to his age, 37, 36 or 37. And he's now still alive, and I still see him every year. He's 96.
Any reason why the air gunners survived longer than the pilot?
Yes, I couldn't really, I had no idea at all. I've been going to reunions, and particularly last year, at the 60th anniversary of the Battle of Britain, I've been going to reunions now for over 20 years. And for the last, I would say for the last 15 years at least, the only people I've seen who I know from those days of 1940 are all air gunners. The pilots were either killed during the war or have died since through various reasons. And as far as I know, up to this day, I don't know of any pilots of my time on that squadron who are still alive. I only know air gunners. There are five of us, and we meet every year.
What rank did you have at this time?
Leading aircraftman, LAC.
Did you have any particular friend in this squadron?
No, we were just friendly as in numbers. But in late May 1940, all air crew, all non-commissioned air crew, were given the rank of sergeant. So we were all made sergeants. We went into the sergeant's mess. We weren't very welcome there because we were referred to as jumped-up sergeants, not got the time behind us to get that rank of sergeant. But it was the Air Ministry directive that all non-commissioned air crew would have the minimum rank of sergeant, the lowest level of sergeant.
So were you treated badly by the...
No, not badly. It was just sort of the atmosphere was initially there, which they came to accept it. I mean, mainly in those years, in 1940, initially, the majority of NCOs would be pre-war airmen. And it had been quite a number of years before they reached that rank. We were suddenly promoted from LAC, which was the rank we had as aircrew in the early part of the war, suddenly promoted to sergeant. And of course it was a bit of a shock to the regular sergeants in the sergeant's mess.
What was discipline like in a squadron at that time?
From memory, I would say it was good. I can't remember any particular time where anything untoward happened, we just got on with it, and I don't think there's any problems. We flew from Catrick down to Redhill to do night flying only, night fighting only on Blenheim, because I say we'd been taken off day flying because there'd been so many losses. And then down at Redhill we started to convert onto bow fighters.
What did you think of the bow fighter?
Oh, quite a good aircraft. The main armament, of course, were cannons, activated by the pilot. And my job was loading and reloading of the cannons, and also being available for the cockpit of the air gunner's position in the mid-upper again, which is a similar situation as to the Blenheim, really. But it was in the early days, and the cannons that we had were not very good. And more often than not, if we got engaged with any enemy aircraft and had to fire, if they fired up to about 10 rounds, they used to, the gun would jam, and it couldn't be, most times it could not be sorted out in the aircraft. We just had to abort the flying whatever we were on and return to base. The guns were fed by belts, belt fed or drum fed. But it was in the early days when they were first introduced, and there was a lot of teething problems.
Going back to the Battle of Britain, had you thought that the Germans might win the war at that time?
Never gave it a thought. No. No, I honestly didn't think anything of it. To me, it was just, I was just doing another job and just got on with it.
Had you thought they might invade?
No.
What kind of operations were you doing once you moved down to Redhill?
Well, it was on night flying on the same job, but in the London area. But mainly called to fly if there's any activity considered that we could be involved with, and we're just sitting on the ground at Redhill, and we'd be just made airborne if our presence was considered to be necessary.
Did you prefer this type of work from the type of work that you've been doing at West Hartlepool's?
Not really, no, because it was, I didn't sort of think anything of it. It was a similar job, same aircraft initially, but at night only and not day, which was a good thing from our point of view, because there was less worries, if there was a worry, of being shot down, because at night the bombers would be coming over, the German bombers would be coming over with no fighter escort. So that trouble was eliminated. We knew that if we were going to be told to fly into any involvement, that almost 99 cases out of 100, there'd be no German fighters there, bombers only. So that did make us a little happier.
Did you find any German bomber streams at night?
Yes, we got involved with quite a number. But, of course, with it being at night, The fact that whether we thought we'd had any success was very difficult to prove. And we just got on with it, and if we got involved, we said we'd had a go, and probably had seen the aircraft that we'd been attacking doing a quick sort of change of height, either through being hit or trying to get away. But if we thought, more often than not, I personally did not get involved with any situation where I could definitely claim, or my pilot could definitely claim, that we'd shot that particular aircraft down. It was a hit and miss.
About what height were you operating at this time?
Anything between, say, 10 and 20,000 feet. Sometimes we just sent out on a patrol, similar to when we were in Khatri, anticipating any movement. Other times we'd just be sitting on the ground and get called off at a moment's notice.
Were the facilities at Red Hill any different from West Hartlepool's?
From a living point of view, no, very similar. My memory is very dim, of course, at this stage, but I don't recall any sort of particular hardship. It was just a matter of moving from one place to another and another environment.
Any incidents that happened to you at this time?
Well, after the Battle of Britain, I was posted onto a wireless operator's course. See, I'd volunteered initially for a wireless operator air gunner. And I was posted to Blackpool, where I did a crash course, as they call it, for about 6 weeks of nothing but Morse code, key bashing, as they call it in those days. And for 6 weeks, it was nothing at all but getting up a speed, up to 24 words a minute on Morse code. And then at the end of that, we were posted to Yatesbury, I think that's in Wiltshire, for the remainder of our training as a wireless operator, all the theory of radio, particular wireless transmitters, and continuing the Morse code. So I then eventually passed out as a wireless operator. So then I was known as a wireless operator air gunner. I was posted back to 219 Squadron. And I was there only a few more weeks, but at one particular period, I was flying with a bow fighter one night, and we were involved with the Heinkel 111, and we claimed it as destroyed. And it was proved fact. It was over Sussex.
Can you describe what happened?
No, we were just... at that time, with bow fighters, we had this new instrument introduced into the aircraft, what they called AI, aircraft interception. It was a radar. And I used to be responsible for operating this set. We'd been directed by the ground section to go to a specific area at a certain height, and then we were left to ourselves to try and find any enemy aircraft. This equipment, what they call this radar set called AI, which I operated, I could get a reading from that, whether there's any aircraft anywhere near us, and I could give the pilot directions to go port or starboard, or increase height or reduce height, until you get in a position where the pilot would see the aircraft that I was guiding him to.
What did the equipment look like?
Like a small television set. Very small.
What appeared on the screen?
There'd be a central line in the middle of the screen, and a horizontal one. And a blip would appear, what they call a blip, would appear on this screen. Similar sort of thing, I suppose, what they see on the air traffic control nowadays, sort of checking and running through an aircraft. And I could, according to where this blip was showing in the screen, on the screen in the centre, if it was more over to the left, that meant the aircraft that we were chasing or being guided onto would be over to our port. So I'd tell my pilot to go starboard to get this blip into a central position. If it was below the centre of the screen, the aircraft that we were chasing would be below us. So I would tell the pilot to increase his height. If it was above the centre of the screen, that meant we were above the aircraft, and I would tell the pilot to reduce his height. And the blip, as we got nearer and nearer to the aircraft, the blip would get bigger and bigger. By the time then, the pilot could see the aircraft that we're following. The reason why we knew it was a German aircraft, an enemy aircraft, and not one of our own, was that in those days, the aircraft used to have in their equipment what called an IFF instrument, which was short for identification, friend or foe. So if you, as soon as you were airborne, you'd have to switch this on, because if you didn't, and you were flying at night in particular, where recognition was a bit sort of iffy, you could be shot down by your own fighters or night fighters, because you would have no way of telling the other aircraft that you were friendly. So that was a real main thing, that if you were flying, particularly by night, to switch this instrument on.